sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor, and they're all really old. And I was going to tell just a quick joke here that I thought was kind of funny, because I believe that humor has a certain degree of spirituality about it, and this may not prove to be funny to anybody, but I kind of like it. This drunk woman walks into a library and goes up to the librarian at the desk and says, "I'd like a hamburger, French fries, and a Coke." And the librarian says, "Ma'am, this is a library." "I'd like a hamburger, French fries, and a Coke." I thought it was kind of appropriate. I could relate to it. But anyway, I was born in Tampa, rare Tampa native. I brought a few notes because I didn't want to forget that one thing that's so terribly important, you know, as if I have anything important to say at all. And I don't know what I did with the notes. First time I spoke, godlike, I was maybe sober for a couple of months, and I was so scared that I could not possibly fill up the 20 minutes. By the way, how long am I supposed to go tonight? 40? Jesus. I don't think I got 40 minutes worth of energy. I was so scared of not being able to fill up the 25 minutes that I had written basically a novel and brought it along with me. And by the time they signaled 1 minute, I was still on before I had my first drink. I was telling, you know, I'd gotten up to about 10 years old, I guess. And so I decided, well, it's better not to have notes and write that stuff down. So I don't know if I can go 40 minutes, but I'll go as long as I can. So I guess my story is a little different than some people in the program. And one thing I'm amazed by are the amount of young people in AA. And I used to think, those people can't be alcoholics. They're way too young to be alcoholics, because, I mean, I can't imagine being, you know, 25 years old and thinking about going into AA. That just seems, and I used to think, well, it must just be because of all these celebrities, that there must be some trendy reason for being in here or something. And I would actually get resentments about that. You know, I think, well, they're just here because it's trendy. And, you know, even if there were any truth to that at all, you know, the fact that you got in here and that you were introduced to this program and these steps and this way of life, what a benefit. I mean, I think that the world could benefit from the 12 steps from an early age, alcoholic or not alcoholic, as a way to live. And anyway, so like I said, I think my life has been in just one that, you know, there's been a lot of tremendous, a lot of self-centered fear that underlies my life and the way I've lived it. And I can think back to really, really early ages. Thank you. Thank you. And so, you know, that's the way it was. I just remember never feeling. And what it did to me was it kind of made me the class clown. You know, I kind of, my yearbooks always said, you're the funniest person I've ever met. Don't change and all this stuff, you know. And what it was for me was a way of coping. I'm not complaining, you know. I'm happy that I could make anybody laugh, but it's the way I coped with it. And so I didn't, you know, I was really a good kid in junior high and high school. I didn't get into any trouble. I didn't drink or drug or, you know, but it wasn't as common for kids in junior high and high school to drink and drug in the late 50s, you know, as it is. I mean, now it's like my daughter, somebody left a bag of pot at my house at a party one time when my daughter was about 12, and she found it, and I lied to her and told her it was tobacco because she knew the guy that left it smoked a pipe. And years later, that subject came up, and she said, you told me that was tobacco. And I said, yeah. And she said, I was already smoking pot by then. And she was 12, you know. And I thought, oh, my God. And so I was a good kid. One other quick story. I remember in seventh grade, there used to be these books that went around called slam books. And they were, I don't think they have anymore, but they basically, you put somebody's name and what do you think of them, and they circulated around the school, and I was never popular enough to get in one, and there was a girl that I had a mad crush on, so I came up with my own slam book and made sure that she got it and was so excited to see what she thought about me. And I remember going back to my desk and opening it, and it said, looks like a monkey. And I'm pretty sure that's why I'm an alcoholic, because of that. Never got over that. And I saw her at a high school reunion 20 years later, and she was not somebody I was would have had a crush on. She looked like a damn monkey, for God's sake. But so that's kind of the way it was for me. I really had my first drink the night I graduated from high school. I went to a party, and I had one scotch and one beer and threw up all over the place. Made me sick as a dog. And I thought, I'll never do that again. That was just god-awful. I didn't like it. You know, probably an indication that I was a little allergic to alcohol, you know, throwing up from that little bit. And it wasn't like I chugged them. It was over a period of an hour. Anyway, so I didn't drink again for a long time. I graduated from high school. I went to junior college. I wasn't a drinker. No, that's not true. I was a drinker. But not, you know, I started drinking in my early 20s like everybody else I knew did. You know, I would go to the bar and, I mean, I guess the difference is they would order a beer and I'd order a pitcher for me and drink it out of the pitcher usually. But that didn't last for a long time. And, you know, progressing on, I quit junior college. I got into a sort of a rock and roll band, and I thought, well, this is it. I'm never going to have to work. I'm going to make a lot of money doing this. And, you know, didn't go back to school for a long time. And went to New York and cut a record, and nothing ever happened with it, and blah, blah, blah. And went back to school, and, you know, all of this time. And then I still wasn't really drinking very much. I really didn't start drinking until a little later, alcoholically anyway. And so I went to, I graduated from college, I got married, had a fairly normal life. I would actually drink, you know, I'd buy a six-pack on the weekend, and it would last me through the weekend, you know. And I've heard people say, well, then you're not an alcoholic. Well, there's more. And so that's what I did, you know. And I could have had a really pretty nice marriage with a good family and everything else. But somewhere into that marriage, my drinking started to increase. And I started to drink, you know, all the time. I started to drink, well, I wouldn't say all the time, but I would drink, you know, a six-pack Friday night, a six-pack Saturday night, a six-pack Sunday night. And then it became, you know, more that much every night. And eventually, towards the end of that marriage, I was, you know, doing the thing of going to work, hungover every day, waking up in the mornings thinking I will never, ever do that again, feeling God-awful. And by about, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when you're that young, you start to feel pretty good again. And I would forget that I had just told myself I wouldn't do that again. And I would, I would go through the routine of, I just go have one beer tonight on the way home from work, and then I'll be home. Maybe I'll go home and be a good boy. And that never happened. I would shut the bar down every night, night after night after night. I would sit there. I would call my wife up from the bar, saying, why aren't you down here? Well, she wasn't down there because she was home with my two kids, which I thought was, why would you do that? I couldn't understand why anybody would not come to the bar and get drunk. Would rather be home with the 2 and the 4-year-old. It's like, well, they can take care of themselves. That 4-year-old is a little older than she, her age. And that's the way I thought. And I went to that bar, every night. It was a bar full of people that I had absolutely nothing in common with except for the fact that they drank like me. They were a bunch, I hate to say this because I love them, they're friends that I grew up with, but they were, basically racist and rednecks, and I wouldn't go there if it weren't for the fact that every one of them drank like I did. And I could go there without any money and get drunk every night because I could, I could whine and complain about how broke I was, even if I really was or wasn't, and there were enough people I knew there to get me good and drunk. And I would do that, like I said, night after night after night for, 2 or 3 years until my wife finally had enough of it, and I was asked to leave that marriage. So I did, and what I did was, and I thought at the time, well, really, it's just that I'm unhappy in this marriage. If it weren't for this marriage, I probably wouldn't drink like this. So I moved out into an apartment and was somehow miraculously able to find an apartment that was about from here to the corner from a bar. So it was perfect. I didn't have to drive. I could walk to the bar. And, I can remember my son coming over to stay with me on the weekends or whatever and saying, I'll be right back. And I had the best of intentions to walk across the street and get a drink and come back and spend time with him. But, it was usually 1 or 2 in the morning when I got back, and he was probably 10 or 11 at the time. And, those are the things that I think if you're young and you're in this program, I can only say that alcohol for me gave me absolutely no chance of living a normal, happy life, having a normal, happy relationship with another human being. I lost the family because of that. I had bad relationships with my kids because of that, mainly because I was just never there. I didn't take any interest in anything they did. I did coach soccer. I coached my son's soccer team for a while, but by the end of that, I was usually, 3 sheets to the wind when it was time to kick the first ball, and thought nobody really knew. And, that's the thing about alcohol is it deprives you of any kind of normal life. It just takes it away from you. It becomes my only interest was to get drunk. Above all else, if I was going somewhere with friends or my wife or anything and drunkenness was not involved, if it wasn't somewhere where people didn't drink a lot, I didn't want to go. That doesn't sound like fun to me. So I would, I would go and get really drunk, and after a while, nobody asked me to come anymore, so I didn't have to worry about going to those places, So that's what it did for me, and like I said, if you're young and you can, if you can get through without having to go through that stuff, even if a marriage is wrong or whatever, at least it's, you can look back on it and think, well, I did what I could have, and blah, 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 and, I can't say that. I was drunk too much. So that continued. I got kicked out of that marriage, or I got kicked out of that house, and within about 3 months, I had met somebody, probably not even 3 months, a month, I had met somebody who drank just like I did and promptly got a divorce and married her and thought, you know, this is it. This is the way it should be. I should be with somebody that understands me. You know, so that's what I did, and that was just god-awful. That was just, I mean, it was 15 minutes of, this ain't too bad, to 45 minutes of, Jesus, what have I gotten myself into, you know? And here's the part, you know, myself being the codependent that I am, it took me 10 years to get out of that marriage. I was scared to death to be alone. I couldn't stand the thought of, you know, I just, you know, being alone just scared the hell out of me. Didn't want to do it, so I stayed in it, you know. And then it's one of those things when you get out of it, you look back on it and you think, what was I thinking? You know, what was I doing? Well, I was drunk most of that time. And here's the funny part. That woman had moved here from San Francisco and had a heroin addict boyfriend and alcoholic and had been around AA. And she actually introduced me. She took me to my first AA meeting. And I remember her saying her name and saying that she was an alcoholic, and I think she probably is. And then we would go home, and she would say, you mind if I have a glass of wine with my grandmother? And I would think, oh, my God, I would be furious. I would think, wait a second here. You want me to go get sober and go to this thing, and you're going to come back here and have a glass of wine. What about me? And I was, you know, I was miserable. I didn't like it, but I didn't drink for 5 years. That was about 1991. That's when I first came into the program. And back when Yana was half the size of it, what it is today, and it was a smoking meeting, and you could barely even see anybody in there because of all the smoke. There were a lot of smoking meetings back then. And so I, you know, I tend to skip around a little bit, but That's all I need to say, don't do this. I went to meetings for 5 years from, I don't know, 91 to 96, something like that. And that's all I did. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't work the steps. I wanted absolutely nothing to do with the fellowship. You know, when people would say, you want to come out to eat with us? I would think, I don't want to go. Why would I want to go out to eat with you? You know, I have nothing in common with you people. And, you know, the fact is I had everything in common with them. I'm an alcoholic, but I considered myself unique. You know, I thought nobody here can really get me. I'm special. And this is funny because my son, who's in the program now for about 5 years, told me the other day that he'd always thought of himself as special. And I thought, oh boy, you know, I hope you will realize just how special you are before it gets you into trouble. And so I didn't do any of those things, and it was absolutely miserable. I was absolutely miserable for that five-year period, and I was like a pressure cooker. You know, I was waiting to explode because, in my opinion, being a dry drunk is worse than drinking, you know, except for you're less likely to kill yourself or somebody else, but it ain't no fun. I can attest to that because you feel all of this pressure because all of that stuff that underlies your alcoholism, all that stuff that you drank over, all that stuff that you can get relief from in the steps doesn't go away. And I was like a pressure cooker, and I can remember, you know, still full of fear. My wife at that time, after that, I remember that just about exactly 5 years, she said, I'm going to the beach this weekend with my girlfriends. And, of course, for me, here comes the fear. That means she's going over there to meet a man or whatever, you know. And so I was scared to death. You know, I look back at it now, and I think of all the insane behavior that I've had in relationships. It's all fear-based, you know. I can trace it to that. And so I was scared to death, and off she went. And I was seeing a therapist at this time, a psychiatrist who had put me on Prozac. And I remember when she left thinking, well, you know, I don't know, he said you can't cuss in here, which I can't imagine not being able to cuss in an AA meeting, but I'll say F. And so so I said, F it. I'm going to go get drunk. And I remember exactly, there's a bar by my house, and I thought, well, I can walk over there. I can have a couple of beers. I won't have to drive. I knew enough not to do that by this time. So I walked to the bar, walked in, looked around, and I thought to myself, what a bunch of losers. Look at all these people in here getting drunk. They're just a bunch of losers. I know a lot more than they do. Can I have a beer, please? And so, you know, I had 3 or 4 beers. That was it. I went home and I thought, okay, I got my taste of it. I don't want that life again. And guess where I was the next night? I was back with the losers, and this time I was right there with them. I had everything in common with them after 3 or 4 beers. You know, it's interesting how when you walk in there, even in a bar, you feel a little funny and not like you don't fit in, but after 3 or 4 beers, everybody there is your best friend. You got plenty to say to them. They're charming, you're charming, you know, the whole bit. So that's what I did. And I was awakened the next morning about 6 a.m. by a half a bottle of warm beer being dumped on my head. She had come home a little early. And I've never said this in a meeting before, too, but she woke up to me in the bed with a prophylactic or two scattered around and a man's hat. And I thought, wow, what kind of evening was that? And I remembered sometime during the next day, you know, I think I brought a couple of men home from the bar last night. That was a switch for me. And, you know, I sure hope I had a good time. Apparently I did by the looks of the place. Though I really couldn't tell you what happened. So anyway, that was an interesting evening. And, you know, so I kind of decided at that point, maybe I should go back into AA. You know, maybe it might not be a bad idea. At least when I bring the men home, I could remember it if I was sober. So I went back into AA, and I did the same thing. I got no sponsor. I did not work the steps, couldn't tell you one step from the other. Nothing changed. Well, I have to say, during all of this time, from 1991 until 2008, I smoked pot all the time. I mean, not on an all-day kind of thing, but I smoked it every day. And so, you know, I always used to think, well, hell, I've been sober, but, you know, I really was not sober. I was really stoned a lot. And, you know, but I never had DUIs. I kept the job. I had a good business that did really well. I didn't have any consequences other than marriages that I, you know, lost and, you know, that kind of thing. And so, you know, this is when I was still married to the same woman that dumped the bottle of beer on my head and blah, blah, blah. And that lasted about 10 years. And, you know, I got out of that marriage, and I was really happy to be out of that marriage. I wasn't drinking, but I wasn't happy. I was still a dry drunk. And I was out of that marriage for about a year, and I met somebody else. And I got married again, my third marriage. This time it was to somebody who'd been in the program before, who's a very good person, and I still think the world of her. But that didn't work out either, unfortunately. A lot of fears and stuff still in there for me. And I remember specifically one night after we had had sort of an argument, I could sense that she was going to leave me. And she had said, you know, I don't know if I love you anymore. And, of course, that's scary news to somebody like me, or it used to be. And I remember driving around. I decided, well, you know what? I'm going to kill myself then. And I was miserable still. I was a dry drunk pressure cooker. And I remember dramatically ripping the hose off the lawn and showing her. Oh, let me go back just for a second. The second wife, this is a good scene. The second wife, I remember looking out the window one day, thinking, what the hell's going on out there? And she's on the front lawn, ripping her wedding dress to bits with gritted teeth. And, of course, me, I roll the window down and said, is there something the matter, my dear? Are you angry? That's me. That's the kind of humor that got me where I am today, successful. Anyway, so the third wife was great. I thought it was going to be good. And this happened, and I was going to, you know, I was going to kill myself. I was driving around with a hose in my car, and then I trying to figure out where to pull off and stick the thing in my exhaust. And I thought, well, I could just go home and get in my garage, but, you know, then there's somebody there. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. And I remembered, it started to dawn on me that, you know, maybe my problems are of my own making. You know, maybe all this trouble that I have are of my own doing. You know, that was a novel idea for me, because I always thought, if only they, you know. And so I remembered enough about the fourth step, though I'd never done it, that it had to do with taking a look at yourself. And I thought, well, man, you know, I need to go to an AA meeting, because I hadn't been to one in 6 or 7 years, even though I wasn't drinking. And I drove around, and I remembered there used to be one at Palmacia, and I went to it. It was a Palmacia 12-step study group, and they were on the fourth step. And I thought, wow, this is something. And so all the therapists and all the psychiatrists and I'd been to for years, off and on, I was never honest with any of them. You know, they would say, well, I go to AA, and they say, you work in the program, and they may as well have been speaking in a foreign language. It's like, what do you mean working the program? I'm not drinking. What else do you want me to do? You know, isn't that good enough? And they would just stare at me. And so I remember, you know, going to that meeting, opening the book, the step four, and for the first time, for some reason, AA clicked to me. I started to look at the book, and I started to think, well, here's my problem, for God's sakes. It's all right here in this book. You know, I'm an alcoholic. This is my deal. This is what's wrong with me. This is why I do the things I do, behave the way I do, at least in part. And so I thought, you know, okay. So the next night I went to a meeting, and I was thinking, you know, I guess I need to get a sponsor. And I was sitting in the meeting, and I was telling this story about driving around with the hose in my car. And some man in the front spoke and said, you know, I was talking about going in my garage with the hose, and he said, you know, I would have been right there with you, but I had a carport. And I said to myself, there's my sponsor. And that became my sponsor. It just took something that simple to identify with somebody. You know, it was just that one thing that broke the ice for me and made me feel connected to somebody. And he became my sponsor, and he's still my sponsor, and he's just been a fantastic sponsor. He's a great man. I love him. And you know, I started to work the steps. I got a home group, which is Palmacia 12-step study group on Sunday nights, and Palmacia Presbyterian. I started doing service work. I set the meeting up every Sunday night for a long, long time. Really enjoyed it. You know, made the coffee, did all of those things. Had a couple of sponsees, but not a lot of success in that area. And I don't think that you necessarily have to. I think if the opportunity arises, you need to. But you can do service work in a lot of other ways that I think sometimes just showing up at meetings, you know, there may be somebody there that's happy to see you there, you know, and there may be somebody there that I'm happy to see that gives me a little boost and makes me want to keep coming back to the meetings and reminds me that I need to be involved in it, because it's a huge difference. And I find even today that as I go through, as my, you know, life goes like this, that the times that I'm the lowest, the times that I'm the loneliest. By the way, I heard Dick, my good friend Dick Drysdale, which a lot of you know, share at a meeting one day. He said, this program has gotten me where I am today, lonely. I thought, yeah. So, you know, those times, I love Dick. Those times when I feel the lowest and, are the times when I'm isolating, the times when I'm not doing anything, when I'm not separating myself from AA, when I'm not doing anything to have any kind of conscious contact with a higher power, which brings me to the God part, which I, you know, like so many of us, didn't want anything to do with God. I always thought that if there's a God, he'll come down and tap me on the shoulder and let me know that he needs me. And, you know, when I first started, right after I came in and I did that and I got the sponsor and we did went through the first three steps, and I did the third step prayer and I began to pray, I was so full of fear. And that was the first thing I asked God to remove, was the fear. And the results were, to me, immediate. I mean, I felt great relief from that. And my whole idea of God has changed. You know, I that's the one thing I think is so beautiful about AA, is that there's no dogma. There's nobody that says this is the God you have to believe in, because I would not be here if that were the case. it's choose a God of your own understanding, you know. And I don't have any idea of a God that sits up there in the clouds with a beard and manipulates things. I have an idea of a force, of a life force that's love and compassion and, you know, wants you to do the right thing. And that's God to me. And when I can live my life like that, I'm much more successful. I'm much happier. And it's a struggle. I go back and forth. I want to take it back. My ego wants to, my thinking wants to run my life. And, you know, I separate myself from the God of my understanding and things don't go well. And so it's kind of one of those things where, you know, what I put into it, I get out of it. If I do nothing, if I don't have any discipline, I don't get a lot out of it. If I do the things I need to do, I get a lot out of it. And, you know, today, I mean, I think AA is just the best thing that's ever happened to me. I think it saved my life spiritually, because I don't think I would have had any kind of spiritual life at all. Though I always thought I did. I was a hippie, a child of the 60s, and always thought I had this great spiritual life. But the truth is, I didn't. It was a self-centered spiritual life. It had nothing to do with others or anything like that. So that's a big, huge plus for me, and I just love it. And I'll tell you one more quick story. I think I'm about done here, aren't I? I mean, I must be close to it. Yeah. Tell you one more quick story. This third wife of mine, we separated for a little while. And, well, we're divorced now, but we separated for a little while. And I moved out and got an apartment, and I could not have any dogs there. And I have two dogs that I love dearly. To me, dogs are as close to God as a living being can get. You know, they love unconditionally. They don't ask for anything. They're always happy to see you. And anyway, so I really missed him, and I decided I was going to sneak my little dog, Frank, in to spend the night with me. And so I brought him over, snuck him into my apartment, and while he was there, I noticed he had, I hope I can say butt. I noticed he had worms coming out of his butt. And I thought, oh, boy, I don't know what it is. So the very next morning, about 7:30 in the morning, I thought, I have to call my wife and let her know about the worms coming out of Frank's rear. So I called her and I said, I just want to let you know that when Frank spent the night with me last night, I noticed he had worms coming out of his butt. And on the other end of the line, I hear, and to whom do you think you're speaking? What a difference one digit on the phone makes. I had given some woman, quite a surprise at 7:30 in the morning to let her know about the night I had before. Anyhow, I always like to tell that story. I don't know why. I think it's because it's one of the highlights of my life, and that's okay with me. Anyway, I can't suggest strongly keep coming back, and, you know, it's a great program, and if you've gotten here, you've had a spiritual experience, and if you do the deal and you work the program and you do all the things suggested to you, it gets better and better and better. Thank you.